technology in itself is of no particular importance, and that we shouldn't revere just technology, but that it's what we want that technology for, what we want to do with it, and our motives behind it, and for what good does it do? Is am I sort of on the right thing there?
Yes, I think that what I was trying to say was that it's not the physical objects of technology that make the change. I think, as Adam was saying last night about Veblen's sort of ideas and his approach, but that the human beings have a need that produces the technology, and then the way in which it's deployed is the thing that is. It always comes back to human beings are social animals, and whenever we have a piece of technology, it's not an inert thing that makes us want to do things. Although, as Marx describes, the fetishization of the commodity, relations between people become relations between things. So it's not that the ring bayonet automatically made the British forces in India superior. It's that they had a whole sense of how to use them, backing them up, that affected them. Something that occurred to me while I was talking really was that in some ways, you can look up on Wikipedia a thought experiment called the Chinese Room. And I think so this must have been at the back of my mind partly. And it's a thought experiment by a philosopher called, is it John Searle? It's John. Yeah, I know who Searle, but I couldn't check his first name. And the idea being that you can imagine a room in which there's a person and they've been given an instruction manual. And you feed Chinese characters through a slot in the room, and they find a file of letters, follow the instructions, and put a Chinese character back out. And they don't understand what the Chinese characters mean or any importance. But as long as they follow the algorithm, then it will appear as if there's someone conversing in Chinese on the other side of the wall. And the point of the argument of the Chinese Room is that actual human consciousness and intentionality is a key part of our ability to speak. So artificial intelligence doesn't have intentionality, can't really replicate and become truly, truly human without that sort of degree of intentionality. So it's more than just the surface appearances. So I suspect that unintentionally, I'm a victim of my own implicit premises. Oh, someone's got a question. Phew.
Okay, all right. Dougie, I think, wants to come in.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting really about ideology and armies having been better prepared, even although the technology is similar. What about the Second World War? I mean, we don't have a theory of great leaders or bad leaders, but I mean, I think, you know, Hitler's idea of invading Russia, you can say that was a stupid mistake, and it can be the history of stupid leaders or whatever. And I don't know what you think about that, really. You know, in fact, probably starting the Second World War was a stupid mistake from Germany or whatever. So how much is it leaders that caused the problem, and how much is it other factors or whatever you would say?
Well, that's a great example of people making history, but not in conditions of their own choosing. Germany was trapped between a vice of Great Britain and France and of Russia, and it was inevitable one or the other would invade. So it was who got their retaliation in first in terms of breaking the Molotov and Ribbentrop pact. And if Hitler had gone in a bit sooner, without the Molotov and Ribbentrop pact, things could have been very different. But in terms of what I'm talking about, the application of the military ideology, obviously, I mean, you can look at things like the Blitzkrieg as an innovative strategic tool. And anti-fascism and the ideology that a lot of people went to war to stop fascism rather than for any particular purpose. And in the German army, personal loyalty to Hitler. I mean, we can't discount the fact that a lot of German soldiers who swore personal loyalty to him felt themselves very bound by that oath. That was a very effective tool in their arsenal. But it was the objective circumstances that really undid them in the end. So I think that's it's different from the examples I was looking at. So it's, in terms of technology, they were relatively easily matched, although you can look at film Dambusters, and although it kind of spreads this part of this idea that Britain was inventors in their tool sheds coming up with new ideas, the fact is that Barnes Wallace had access to advanced naval warfare floating tanks and all the technology of research to be able to develop his idea of a bouncing bomb, however simply the idea came to him. So the British military technology and advancement, and particularly also of radar, were key, but because they had the infrastructure for developing this technology and were already an advanced technological power.
Cool.
Okay, thanks, Bill.
Okay, Kevin.
That's me, Jim. Sorry, Kevin isn't here yet. Yeah, I totally agree with what you're saying is about. It's not so much the weapon, but the way you think of using it. And I think that's probably more so now. The weapons now are not necessarily guns or rockets or bayonets. They're like the media, our eyes, our ears. Quite interesting when they started to form the Hitler Youth in America, and there was quite a few German submarines. They had midnight parades. All was going well, and there was enough German community in America to keep it going. They were singing their songs, candlelight parades, all this, camps, weekend camps. But then when they started to ship the eugenics books over about, how you should only breed with people with blonde hair and blue eyes, and you get the master race. The youngsters in his camp started to actually do it, and there was a huge amount of unmarried children being born, so underage children, and that was the first time that the Americans were a bit anti-Nazi. I thought, this is against the church. And at that point, the whole system collapsed and the Nazis fled. But with the modern technology I see now, is the worrying things is face recognition programs, the advancement of AI, which is coming in, is already here, but it's becoming cheaper and more available. We at some point become so blind by what's on TV, the radio, AI, and intelligence, which is being gathered and stored at an enormous rate and virtually stored forever. I think for a lot of the youngsters that are going to university now and college in their 20s, they've never really known a left-wing government, which quite often spurs you from a left-wing government into a socialist way of thinking. I feel that most people in this country and probably the world now, their hands are tied so much behind their backs that the idea of having equal weapons is no longer equal, because we can't afford to build the intelligence gathering machines or be in control of the media. I mean, the first time we escaped this was with pirate radio. And I can remember as a kid, I believed in everything that I saw on TV. And then when I started to listen to Radio Luxembourg, and there was different style of music, different sort of music, different way of talking, different way of thinking, then the machines of freedom started to appear, which was motorbikes and scooters, which got the working class kids out to the coast and the countryside. We started to learn more. We started to mix. The chances of a youngster now even being able to afford the insurance on a car is almost impossible. So I totally agree with what you're saying, and I don't know what the answer is apart from education.
Right, there's a lot to unpack there. I don't want to get drawn into, I don't think, a discussion of the history of eugenics, because I think that's a bit outside our scope. I'll just say that I believe that the Americans had their own eugenics laws that the Nazis were copying, so there was an awful lot of it flowing in the other direction as well. But I think you make an interesting point about possession of big weapons. I mean, after all, America had the nuclear bomb and still lost in Vietnam. Okay, that was that their war aims were not compatible with the use of the bomb. Although, obviously, someone with a nuclear bomb, that sort of technological superiority automatically wins wars now. I mean, that's but then it depends on a certain set of infrastructure to even maintain the capacity to have a bomb, and a certain particular set of circumstances in which they could even be used. Let's hope 75 years on from the anniversary of when it was first dropped, it never happens again. And it's up to us to make sure it doesn't by getting rid of the states and the system of international rivalry that would make such a thing possible. Likewise, I mean, the collection of information in itself isn't that threatening, I don't think. I mean, you know, the idea of a health big data set is a wonderful idea, you know, in terms of being able to get your information stored at a hospital down to a genetic and a possible level that predict all sorts of things for preemptive action is wonderful. I think what a lot of people feeling about this is that the existence of an armed state with men of violence at its beck and command that can deploy this big data, or that it's being used to make money out of us rather than for our benefit, I think is why we have a lot of this anxiety. So, you know, the Amazon can sort of like send you adverts and it knows what you want to buy. Well, a socialist algorithm would be wonderful if it could do that, if it could just work out what do people want and, you know, basically either say, yes, do you want this today, or just send it to us without us even asking. That sort of data gathering is, but the fact is that there's a feeling that there's a hostile force that's against us. And I think that's the social context. Over to you, Chair.
Yes, I agree. Absolutely agree with that. But even the search engines like Google, which is one of the biggest, but there's loads of different search engines. But the search engines themselves are geared and only search in certain areas. I think about, I'm not sure, but almost, I think, 9/10 of the internet is the dark web, and there's an even darker web. And they have their own searches like DuckDuckGo and various things that can get you into places where huge amounts of information, which is not checked, it's a bit like being in the Wild West, you know, if you believe in the Wild West. And where law doesn't count and things are good and bad. But I think more and more people are heading towards the dark web because they're beginning to get tired of the search engines and how they're controlled. And it's possible the internet will actually break up into regional internets, like a Chinese internet and a Russian internet and an American internet. And then whatever political party you've got in, they will control the tax of the big companies like Google and Amazon and all these people, and they would in themselves control the search patterns of these search engines. So as a big library, you can go into a library, there's nothing to stop you looking everywhere. What's going to happen with the search engines that most people use is that they will only be sent to certain areas. And this is quite worrying. And I think with a lot of youngsters now that I speak to, heading towards the dark web, they think the dark web is better. Perhaps we need socialist search engines.
No, James, isn't it? Anthony would like to come in. Anthony Green?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can, Anthony.
Ah, good. It's very quiet at the channel, actually. I thought it was a very interesting talk, and I like the example of the Incas being quite an advanced civilization, except they hadn't invented the wheel. And another example of that, because I'm quite interested in Chinese history, because my wife's Chinese and my children half Chinese, is that China was very much in advance of the West in many ways as civilization. but they never invented the wheel. And at least one book I've read have argued that if they had, then they could have had the Industrial Revolution hundreds of years before we had it in Britain, which, you know, would obviously that one invention would have completely changed the modern world, you know. But just the other point, the main point I was going to make, that capitalism, very much it sort of holds back progress now. You know, although we can see, obviously, capitalism has made huge technological advances since Marx's time. We can't deny that. You know, we're using it now. But in many ways, it hasn't been used, as people know, for the betterment of all. You know, I was born in 1962, and growing up in the 70s, we were told by teachers, I think even the Duke of Edinburgh, the Queen's husband, said this, that our biggest problem when we became adults would be having too much leisure time. And of course, people see this hasn't happened. You know, we have all this technology, the mobile phones, the computers, but people are actually in the West are working harder probably than at any time in history. You know, much, much harder than even when we lived in an agricultural society. And I think as we go into more crisis within the economic system and people see that maybe the benefits of technology are going down and down, the benefits that you see are going down and down whilst people are getting richer and richer, I think that poses problems for capitalism in the future, because it's sort of sustained itself by giving us enough, you know, the idea of progress, which has been used to justify imperialism and capitalism and the state capitalist society, Soviet Union, etc., that somehow advancing. And I think people now, certainly in the West, are growing up without the expectation that they will live a better life, an easier life, a life with more leisure than their parents or their grandparents. I think up till now, that has been the case. People have been able to expect a better life, but now I think that is disappearing. You know, as somebody mentioned, people can't afford a house, can't afford a car. They're working God knows how many jobs, how many hours, and really there's nothing left to show for it at the end. And I think that as that becomes more and more apparent, more and more people will turn towards socialistic ideas as, again, you know, as a way forward.
Well, yes, I think that there's some interesting and important points in there. My dad's, when he chides me about not having a machine that can do FaceTime, because I don't have the right sort of technology, but I only have the internet in the house at all because of lockdown. As soon as lockdown's over, the internet's going out. But he says that, you know, when he was growing up, there was one phone on the estate and the council estate, not a country estate. And no one used it because obviously no one had a phone in their houses. And so we've gone from within his lifetime, so since the 1940s, to ubiquitous telephones in everyone's pocket. And the technology has remarkably changed. I mean, even I remember in the 1990s, mobile phones were seen as something rare and exotic and weird, and only poshos and rich people had them. And now, you know, you're a weirdo if you don't have one. And I kept trying to be a weirdo for as long as possible. And you're quite right about the 2015 election, the Tory candidate at Hustings stood up and he proudly said, basically, we're making you work longer and harder than ever before. More people are working longer than ever before. He said this as if it was a good thing. And this is the ideology that they have, is that if we're not using our leisure time, is any economic inefficiency. In a sense. So this is the ideological backdrop of how they look at technology. How can the technology make us work harder? And of course, one of the other outcomes of lockdown has been a kind of vindication of David Graeber's bullshit jobs. I've not read it myself, I know its contents, which is that suddenly millions and millions of people were stopped from working and the world didn't fall around our ears. And we found out who the key workers actually are. And so that sort of example of, well, hang on, we could go to society that's radically different in terms of what we could and couldn't do, and it wasn't the end of the world. So it's these twin things of the possibility and the desire that we need to get in line to make a substantial change. Yes. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's good. Good answer, yeah.
Name, Moggy?
Hello. Thank you for a most interesting talk. Now, I'm sort of jumping back. You said a key word that sort of sparked off something in my imagination when you mentioned bicycles. Now, that reminded me of some years ago. I saw a Shakespearean play where the characters were running around on bicycles. Now, of course, the Elizabethans didn't use bicycles. But when you think about it, they could have invented the bicycle. They had all the components. There was no reason why they couldn't have invented bicycles in the Elizabethan times. But of course, if you'd have given a pile of bicycles to Elizabethan people, they wouldn't have been able to ride them because of the type of clothing they wore at the time. So technology is, I mean, it's not just whether we've got the components to make these things, but can we actually use them at the time? Because of all the other things that are happening at the time and the sort of clothing we're wearing and what restricts our movements and so on, that wouldn't have been a practical time. So the Elizabethans weren't ready for bicycles. You see what I mean?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And in fact, when Von Drees invented his bike, the roads were rutted cart tracks. It took him an hour to go 7 miles. I mean, because he was basically walking with some wheels between his legs. And in fact, they got banned, bicycles, fairly soon because the roads were so poor. People were riding on whatever paving there was. And so it's been going on a long while, this cyclists on pavements problem. But I'm always amazed by the effect of the bicycle as a piece of technology. Because you look at what happened in developing countries where, you know, they suddenly bicycle was there, and it revolutionised their way of life in a way. Now, of course, the Elizabethans, they had horses. I mean, if they wanted to get around, they get on a horse. Why would you need a bicycle? I've got a horse. And of course, you know, 19th century, the problem was there were so many millions of horses in London that the floor was covered in it. Yeah, yes, it takes a whole mesh of things. So even if someone in, you know, Constantinople 800 years ago had come up with the bicycle, he would have probably dismissed the idea as, well, it would work, but what would I do with it? Or if Leonardo da Vinci had drawn a bicycle design, you know, people say he invented the helicopter and all sorts of things, and there was a particular design genius thing going on there, but obviously there was no call for this type of mode of transport. And I think it really wasn't until, I think, the link chain makes the big difference. And then, so that I think that was, I don't know, I haven't looked up when the link chain was invented, but I suspect that came after sort of like various rotational machines, because it's a key feature in them as well. So much later, but yes, I think it's more than just a desire to invent things. It's about being able to put them into some practical use and having the infrastructure that supports them. It's a bit like electric cars. People go, oh, electric cars are terrible. Because obviously there's a petrol station every few miles. The infrastructure's there to support petrol-driven cars, but there were no charging stations. Now, of course, now charging stations are becoming more and more common. It becomes more and more feasible to go, okay, my car can go somewhere I can always charge up if I need to, because the infrastructure is already invested. And likewise, with fossil fuel versus renewables, the infrastructure to burn fossil fuels was there already, so it was all automatically cheap. You had to build the infrastructure for renewables, and that's why they seemed, in the first instance, to be more expensive.
Hmm.
Paddy, you
want to
come in? Paddy doesn't.
Yeah, sorry, I was just. just two counterexamples, actually, because I think I really like the argument that Bill's putting, but I don't think we shouldn't run away with the idea that social development is purely about what people have got a use for and what they want to do with things. I mean, there were technological barriers to things. I mean, some time ago, I was investigating some kind of alternative history story idea about what if the Romans, the ancient Romans, who of course were sat on huge amounts of coal, and also in in Tuscany huge amounts of iron, what if they'd had their own industrial revolution and they were steaming across the European landmass in steam trains? It was a quite a compelling idea, but when I looked into it, of course, I discovered that they didn't have the technology to smelt cast iron, and without cast iron, you can't create a boiler that's strong enough to drive anything like a locomotive. They would just be too, the iron would be too thin, and the boilers would just explode. It's not that outlandish an idea, given that I think the 5th century BC hero of Alexandria was supposedly the first person to devise an actual working steam turbine. But it just couldn't have been done before the Industrial Revolution, as I say, because of the lack of the ability to get the temperatures necessary to smelt cast iron. The other one was, going the other way, was that sometimes inventions predate the ability of anyone to build them. And the particular example I had in mind was Charles Babbage and his digital engine, not his difference engine. The one that he first built was this giant thing made out of cogs and wheels and rotors to calculate logarithmic tables for navigation. But the one that he designed after that on paper was a digital computer, and it was 150 years ahead of anyone's ability to build the thing. And in fact, only in the last few years this computer design of his has actually been modelled and works, I understand, to a surprisingly effective degree. So that's an example of an invention that's ahead of its time. Anyway, that's not to dispute anything that Bill was saying.
Well, it's steam engine fun time, because in fact the very issue that caused Boulton and Watt to have to delay the production of the of their steam engine was in fact the casting of the condensation chambers and getting the iron to the such degree that it could withstand the heat. So yes, it very much was so even in the, let's say, 18th century. Well, because I've had a similar alternative history of what if Romans had gliders, if we could imagine them using ballistas to launch gliders across their empire so they could rapidly move troops and people and communication hundreds of miles in a single day. That would very much have revolutionized things. Of course, part of the point of the initial thing is that although we can look in the abstract that technology might have been technically possible, the interlinking of other capacities to use it and desires to put it into practice would be lacking. And of course, yes, it is entirely possible to theorize an idea before it is realizable, as in Da Vinci's helicopter, and likewise Paul Dirac, who theorized antimatter before we could even begin to experimentally explore its existence. It was just implied by the mathematics. So yes, even the idea coming first is human beings that come first as our first principle of technology. But you're absolutely right. It's context derived. It's not, it can't just fall out of the sky. Technology has to fit in somehow to the society that's going to try and use it. And if it doesn't find a use from people, or if they just physically can't use it because they're lacking another key component, it will sit on the shelf until someone rediscovers it.
Wondering, I'm just curious. You mentioned that you've got the internet, but when lockdown is over, it's going. Is that a question of ideology? Can you expand on that? Is there a reason?
I use the internet all day at work. I won't have it in the house.
Ah, okay.
So it's I just don't, and also just the cost of maintaining it. So at the present moment, I'm paying because I don't have to pay to go to work, because I don't have to pay for the travel. So I'm keeping hold of it, but I just don't particularly want to have it available. And although if party work becomes so dependent I'll have to get it, then I'll have to actually buy a computer. I'm sat here talking to you on my work computer.
Okay.
I'm very wicked.
The other thing, just wondering, and after what James had said, and I'm wondering whether, because of we've got Zoom, because we've got the technology, because we've got the internet, because we've got smartphones, I'm wondering how obedient we would have been in this lockdown without those things. I wonder how obedient we would we have stayed at home? Would we have gone to visit our relatives because we couldn't see them any other way? I'm just wondering whether or not, well, obviously the government has knows damn well that we can do that. But I'm just wondering how obedient we would have been without this technology.
That's a very good question. I mean, for someone like myself living essentially on my own, it's been my link to the outside world and made it very possible. But also, in terms of just getting the communication to make it possible for us to coordinate this sort of level of thing, you know, if you think about if we didn't have all these devices in our homes, it would be World War II style propaganda. We'd just wall to wall, and you'd have to have wardens on the streets and everything. It would just have been a ferocious undertaking. And also, I mean, it does feed into a kind of a point about the coronavirus thing that we may be missing at the moment, which is the marvel of technology that is actually a part of all of this. Although it's horrible, 60,000 people have died in this country and that sort of thing. But, you know, we modelled the genome within weeks. We are now apparently the survival rate of ICU has basically gone down to 75% survival rates from ICU. So that's a huge increase in how to treat it. And this is a rapidly evolving modern disease. So although the historical parallel is the influenza pandemic of 1919-20, the fact that we've got this technology now means that I think we are going to beat it, and it will be looked back on as a triumph of technology. And the outliers like Britain and the United States, it will be seen as failures of technology and a failure to adapt properly enough. So yes, I think that there's a lot to be learned from what's happening, but it was a bit early to come back on that. Oh, I've rattled Paddy's cage.
Okay, is it Kevin or James?
James, sorry.
James, right. Okay, yeah. No problem.
Kevin's just arrived, but he's all hot and sweaty, so but he'll be on at 4 o'clock. Yes, so I've noticed that a lot of inventions can be 100 or 200 years. I mean, a lot of the modern technology we're using now comes from Tesla. But the technology and the inventions can only come at the right time with other inventions. Give you example with the bicycle and the penny farthing and the bone shaker. I mean, if you're on those bicycles on cobblestones, you're going to be almost killed, you know. You'll be shaken to bits and killed. But until someone invents the mountain bike with pneumatic tyres, which is another invention on top of that invention, and it comes in at the right time, you have the perfect tool. And people like Clive Sinclair, and these people are great at drawing in talent and using lots of small inventions to make better inventions. But then again, I'm a great believer in slowing down. Everything is based now on growth, profit, and shareholders. Let's go back to a time before we didn't have all this. I can remember we were, me and my father in the 1960s, early 1960s, were the first people to drive an electric vehicle, which was an RACS milk float. And previous to that, we was on horse and cart, and I used to, on Saturday and Sundays, go out with him on the horse and cart. And we had about a 7-hour milk round on a Saturday. Well, the horse would follow us up. The horse knew the round. The horse remembered the round. And as we would carry 7 or 8 pints each under our arms, between our fingers, we would walk ahead, putting the pints of milk down. And the horse would follow us up, and it wouldn't scratch a car. It would draw the milk float, and it would park right next to the curb. In our time, we switched to the electric milk floats, and all of a sudden these great big green vases of acid came in, and electrical engineer came in. We had all these different things. And, of course, we had to keep walking back down these roads to bring the milk float up. So that was lost time. And instead of taking 6 or 7 hours, on a Saturday, you'd probably work for like 10 hours. So in some cases, modern technology is going backwards. And also, I can remember working on a tree plantation for the GLC. When I first started, we used hoes. We had miles and miles of holes of trees, these saplings. We've only got to damage the bark on these saplings and the tree dies. And the next field was the Yehudi Menu School of Music, and all this violin music will be drifting across. And you get a rhythm with a hoe, you get a rhythm with the scythe. And you don't get tired because you're into a rhythm. It wasn't hard work. It wasn't dusty work. You could talk to a person working opposite you. And all of a sudden, time of motion came and this came. We all had these giant tractors. Then we had diesel tanks and diesel. We then had dust. We had to wear face masks. The tractors made the soil like concrete. So I'm hoping through socialism and AI can also slow down. Do we need to work as hard? Do we need to work as fast? Do we need to spend 3 hours a day travelling from the suburbs to London and back, you know? I think in this COVID world has shown us that there is a different world, and it's given us a glimpse of what the socialist world could be like. So I think in that way, in a small way, this COVID world has become a positive thing for socialism.
I don't think I've got anything to add to that.
Keith?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the bike and clothing. I thought Maggie made a really, really interesting point about, you know, give Elizabethans a pile of bikes and they'd say there's no good to us because of the clothes we wear. Now, you could turn that round, of course, and say, if you've got a pile of bikes, this clothing's no good for riding a bike, so we'll have to change the clothing. Now, that's important because historically that's exactly what happened. Women couldn't ride bikes because they wore skirts. What do? They scandalised the world by dividing the skirt. And not only that, the bicycle gave them an unprecedented opportunity to get away from their husbands. It gave them a freedom which scandalised people, and people tried to close down on. So there you've got, I think, a really good example of, if you've got some advance in technology and social relations and social life in general don't fit, you don't just give up on the technology, social life changes. That's a very good illustration, it seems to me, of one of the points in Adam's talk last night. And it also underlines something I've long believed, and that is that there's a very, very strong parallel between Karl Marx's theories and the bicycle. Both essentially 19th century inventions. The point of both of them was woefully misunderstood in the 20th century. They are both really going to come into their own in the 21st century, I hope.
Yes, you reminded me, I've got to try and sneak in William Gibson's famous quote, that the street finds its own use for new technology. Which is another thing, which is that sometimes a new technology comes along and people find the most unexpected uses. I mean, you know, you look back to 1960s science fiction shows, obviously because of the needs of a television series, people had video phones because they could have people, actors talking at both ends and much better than a telephone. And of course, these sorts of technologies people didn't dream of until they're suddenly in our hands, and suddenly we go, oh, actually we can start doing this with this piece of technology, and we can have short videos about how to fix your bike on demand on YouTube and this sort of thing. So and of course I've just been looking at the Wikipedia article. It took 70 years for the first rear wheel chain driven bicycle to come along after the bike was initially invented. So it took its while to really change that. And of course the addition of the chain is the real breakthrough of creating a very viable bicycle. The history of the bicycle page is actually fascinating to read. I think I'll have to steal that idea of Marx being like a bit like a bicycle whenever someone says it's an outdated ideology. I think that's a very good point.
Paddy, do you want to come in?
Yeah, just to go back to the question you asked a bit ago, or somebody asked a bit ago, you know, if we didn't have all this wonderful technology today, the internet, video and catch-up TV and all this other wonderful stuff that we've been all glued to, would it have been impossible to enforce lockdown? Well, out of interest, just a few weeks ago, I read an article about the 1665 plague in Britain, where, surprise, surprise, they had a lockdown and social distancing. And apparently people, and we know this from Samuel Pepys's diary, and apparently people by and large did stick to it, possibly because the plague is quite a bit more terrifying than possibly COVID is. So I imagine that they took it quite a bit more seriously. I think if you're seeing cartloads of bodies passing your window every day, you tend to sort of take the idea of lockdown a little bit more seriously. But also because today's, unlike the plague, today's pandemic seems to largely affect old people. So, you know, young people understandably aren't so bothered and aren't taking the precautions. And we know this because once the restrictions were relaxed and people started going to pubs again, 60% or around about 60% of new cases, new outbreaks across Britain and across the world are in people under 30. So I think that does explain, you know, what would have happened if this had happened before the internet. Well, it did.
Nothing to add to that. It's a good point.
Thanks, Paddy. Moggy?
Hello. Yeah, just harking back to this thing about people working from home during the lockdown. What's happened here in New Zealand is that once we came out of lockdown and people could go back to work, a lot of people found that they actually enjoyed working from home and they would continue working from home. Or some people decide that they will work from home so many days a week and go to the office just perhaps once or twice a week. So that is maybe going to be the new normal now.
Yes, I think it's certainly an element of that is going to go on. And of course, what happened with working from home historically for a long time was, I think, a lot of employers thought that people wouldn't and that they'd swing the lead. And I think that what they found is that people can and do work. And I think obviously what you do get is I'm not giving the game away here, I don't think. There is a different approach to work. So whereas when you're stuck at work and you're watching the clock towards the finish of day, you know, you just sit down and you have your bit of presenteeism going on. Whereas in lockdown, when you're working from home, you work till you finish the job for the day and then you stop. And I think that might well change the way a lot of people work. But then the threat is being made to someone on social media saying, well, if you can work from home, your job could be put anywhere in the world where they can speak English. So you should be trying to damn well prove that you're doing your job. Well, yes and no. But I think there's a certain amount of employers will seek to want to have that sort of like the discipline of the workplace available to them.
Hugh, Mike?
Yeah, it was just a quick point about the sort of working from home thing. And I think a lot of companies and organisations would have worked out they can save quite a bit of money with staff working from home. I mean, the office I used to be based at, that hasn't reopened since it closed in March, and nearly everyone's working from home. But I suppose one difference is now compared with before is that and on the whole sort of swinging the lead or skiving off issue is that even if you've got a whole group of people separately working from home, what they're doing can of course still be monitored by managers who can, you know, if everyone's working from a system which is linked up, they can still work out who's doing what and who isn't doing what. So the technology makes it easier on the one hand, but also makes it easier to monitor on the other. And yeah, of course, some checks and balances are common sense, but I'm guessing. In previous decades, working from home, you know, people saw it as a bit of a skive because, you know, that there'd be less evidence, if you like, of what they're doing or not doing. But of course, now everything is so heavily monitored through technology. People can be sort of monitored closely, and so that they don't bunk off or you know, just sit around in the garden getting drunk at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Cheers.
And I just added, there's also a bit of a sea change in their approach, because they I suppose this is the real and formal subsumption to capital type thing going on here. So my employer says to me, you know, I need to buy my own IT kit and pay for my own internet. And they go, well, yeah, but you're not paying your travel fare to work. But then again, that means that I am basically paying to work and paying the equipment costs. And they say people should buy their own desks and their own office chairs. People are working for, there's ructions about this over various people. And there is this change in the balance of power. And yes, in some companies where they can monitor what you're doing, and in others, it's just you have to monitor the outputs. And it's, well, you know, accepting that it's an emergency temporary measure. And of course, my employers turned around and said, we want everyone back when we can reopen. So there's, I think they might try and clamp down and prevent a mass return to home working, but we'll see how it all works out, because some of the various adaptations we're going to have to make for coronavirus are going to mean that we're not going to be able to have very many people in the office at all anyway.
Howard, are you there?
Very sorry, I didn't unmute. I've done it now. Right, I'll repeat what I just said then. I think what we heard from Bill basically was an expression of dialectical materialism, in the examples he gave of South America and India and one or two others, what was happening was that particular material conditions existed, which in part determined the way people behaved and the way they interacted with their environment. But the other factor, which you can never take away, you've always got to consider, is the role of ideology. You know, the particular ideas around at the time, the ideology of the society interacting with the material conditions to determine precisely how things shall operate and how they shall move forward and if that's what they're doing at a given time. So that's the sort of overriding, perspective that I got from what Bill was saying.
Thank you. And you managed to sum it up in 2 minutes when it took me half an hour. But, you know, that's what I was being asked to do, I suppose.
James, do you want to come in? Is it James? Is James coming in?
Sorry, I was just, tending to the stove.
Oh, okay.
Of course, just saying. Just give me a few seconds to recapture. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Getting back to what Mike Foster was saying about working from home and as technology, which is already there in the office, is now being used in the home. You log in and immediately they can tell how active they are. They can see the amount of keystrokes you're doing. We've got VoIP, so you can have meeting after meeting. What we're doing, we're like prisoners. We are being tagged. And also comes from what went down to Lidl. When you go to Lidl, they have a very, very small area, probably less than one square yard. Probably less than one square yard, where all the food on this belt is pushed into this small area. So they're pushing it through. And if you don't load your bag up fast enough, you really have a fear that it's all going to go on the floor. So I stopped this guy. I said, please stop. I said, I can't load my bag fast enough. I'm on my own. And there's no greeters or helpers or anything. He said, no, I have to push it through. I'm being monitored at the speed. I do the keystrokes on the till, and the speed that I push it through at is being monitored. So I said, you're being monitored. But I said, if the stuff breaks on the floor, surely that's bad customer care. He says, no, we're all being monitored all the time. So I thought to myself, where are we going with the new technology, you know?
The time is now. We needed a bit of a break before the next talk. So I don't know if you want to.
I was just thinking that was a good question on which to end it all.
Right. Okay, so if there's no one that wants to, desperate to comment or make a or ask a question, I think we'll wrap this up now. We can all go and have a cup of tea or something and be nice and refreshed for the next talk.
Thank you.
So thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.